So we are continuing with our series in Ruth. Oh. We are continuing with our series in Ruth today. And because there's a whole narrative across all of the book, I just wanted to start by just recapping what we'd discussed in chapter 1 and in chapter 2. So Bert preached on chapter 1 2 weeks ago. And if you remember, we have the story of some widows. We've got Naomi, who's an Israelite. She comes from Bethlehem. She moves to a new country. Her husband dies, but her kids get married. Her kids then die. Her sons die. And she's left with these two daughter-in-laws, Ruth and Orpah. And Orpah decides to stay. Ruth decides to move back to this foreign land, to Judah, to Bethlehem, where she doesn't know what's going on, but she wants to stay with Naomi. And the message of Bert's sermon then 2 weeks ago was about God's sovereignty and how important it was to trust in God, and how Ruth showed that. And then last week, Antsy talked us through chapter 2. And in chapter 2, Ruth ends up in a field. She ends up gleaning. So gleaning is this process of gathering up kind of the scraps of the harvest that are left behind by the harvesters. And it turns out that she's in a field of a relative called Boaz. And Boaz shows kindness to Ruth. He makes sure that she's protected. He makes sure that his workers, his male workers, don't pester her. He makes sure that they drop enough food for her to pick up, so that she's got lots of food. And Antsy's message was about us gleaning, us picking up, us having a redeemer, Jesus, who is kind to us and generous to us. And so that leads us to chapter 3. And before we read chapter 3, there's just maybe a couple of things that are not clear about the end of chapter 2 and then the start of chapter 3. So firstly, in chapter 2, we've got this gleaning happening. That only happens during the harvest, right? It doesn't happen all year round, because you can only do that when they're gathering crops. That only happens once a year. And harvest would typically take about 6 weeks to happen. So if you imagine what Ruth and Naomi are doing, if they arrive in Bethlehem at the start of the harvest, they start gleaning at the start of that period, they've only got 6 weeks of gathering food. And then they're kind of back to, I don't know what happens next. So that's kind of the first thing just to keep in mind as we start chapter 3. Both of them are widows. And in that society, it's not like they had other options. They couldn't go and get another job. They couldn't rely on anybody else for help. The only option that they had is this idea of a redeemer, which we'll talk about later. But that's not a guarantee. And just from Boaz's perspective, all of chapter 2, if you look at chapter 2, all of it up until maybe the last three verses, all happens in one day. It's the first day that Ruth goes, and Boaz notices her, and he shows kindness to her. But then the next thing that happens is the end of the harvest period. So we don't actually know what's happening between Boaz and Ruth. We talk about this book like it's a love story, and by the end of it, it is. But at this point, at the start of chapter 3, there's no guarantee that Boaz is actually expecting anything to happen. He might want something to happen, but he's an older guy. This young lady, maybe beautiful, maybe not, we don't know, comes in. He might notice her, but why would he expect anything to happen? He's probably going to expect her. She's foreign as well. He's not expecting her to stick to Israelite tradition. He might be just expecting her to just find a young man and marry off. And we'll see that that's his expectation in chapter 3. And then finally, the start of chapter 3 begins with Boaz doing this thing called threshing. Threshing happens at the end of the harvest season. So we know when we're going into chapter 3 that it's now the end of the harvest season. So with that in mind, we'll read the passage. I'm not putting it on the screen. I thought, instead of staring at your phone and completing whatever computer game you're playing at the minute, or checking your Instagram feed to see what photos Antsy's putting on for her lunch in Hong Kong, I thought it'd be nice to actually look in at your Bible apps, or if you've got a physical Bible, that would be good too. So let's turn to Ruth 3, and we'll read. So Ruth chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. Now it's true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring your garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. So let's just consider the position that Ruth and Naomi are in at this point, as we've read through that. Ruth and Naomi are basically out of food. They might have stored up enough food that they could survive for a few more weeks, but it's the end of the harvesting period, so they can't glean anymore. Boaz, there's no indication at this point that Boaz is going to continue to look after them in any other way. So we don't really know what's happening. And if you're familiar with this, the hierarchy of needs, if you think about where Ruth and Naomi are, they're at the bottom of this list. They're on the physiological needs. These are the things that we need in order to feel content in life. And at the bottom of that is the most important things, food, water, shelter. Naomi and Ruth are at the bottom of this. They're focused on providing just their food, just making sure that they've got enough to eat. And they can't focus on these other things because they're just focused on this. This is quite a common psychological kind of concept. If you've not heard of it, you can just look it up online. It's pretty common. So they're at the bottom of the pyramid, and they know that what little food they've got is going to run out. And we see this in verse 1 of chapter 3. Naomi says, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Naomi knows that actually they can't keep doing that. They can't keep living a life of poverty. They can't keep living a life of destitution, because that's what it would be for widows that weren't provided for in the time. So they know, they recognize that they're helpless by themselves. There's nothing that they can do to get themselves out of this situation unless they find someone that they can speak to, unless they find this redeemer. So what happens is Ruth and Naomi take the initiative. Just like in chapter 1, they took initiative. They decided they were going to leave the land of Moab and move to Bethlehem. In chapter 2, Ruth takes the initiative to go gleaning and go gathering in the fields. And here again, we see they take initiative. They're trying to pursue something better than just survival, than just finding food. They're trying to move their way up this pyramid. So they hatch a plan, which, having read the passage, kind of seems like an odd plan for two defenseless women to come up with. Okay, so just to put this into perspective, already we can see in the passage that Ruth is told to go and lay down at the feet of this man and ask him in her best clothes and say, oh, could you cover me with your blanket? That's already seeming a little bit questionable, but it's even worse than that, because Boaz is threshing. So threshing, The way that that works is you take your crops that you've gathered, you throw them up in the air, and as you throw them up in the air, wind comes and it blows away the chaff. This is where we get the expression, separate the wheat from the chaff. And the wheat then falls down because it's more dense, heavier, and you can collect it up. But to do that, you need wind. So in kind of the Mediterranean climate, the best time for wind is kind of at nighttime. Once the air starts to cool down, you start to get convection currents. So threshing happens at nighttime. Okay, so it's even more risky than we originally kind of see in the passage. To get wind, though, you can't be doing that in the middle of a city. You can't be doing that in Bethlehem because there's with the wind won't have, the buildings will block it. So the threshing floor is normally located outside of the city, fairly far away. It's normally on a hill so that you can get the most amount of wind possible. And what the threshing floor actually is it's just a big stone slab in the ground. Okay, so you throw your grain up and then you've got a nice flat stone surface to collect all your grain on. And the reason that Boaz is sleeping there at all is because that's his whole livelihood. It's at risk of thieves coming and just taking his grain in the night. So he chooses to, or like any farmer would do, he chooses to sleep there to protect his grain. So it's nighttime, it's far away. We know that there's thieves around that might try and take the grain. Okay, and then this is what Ruth is told to do. She's told to wash and put on her best clothes, put on her perfume, make herself as nice as possible. Go to this place, this isolated place where there's potential robbers. No one's around except this one guy. Watch him eat some food, have a drink, and then once he's had a drink, wait for him to go to sleep, lie down at his feet, uncover his feet, and then ask to be covered by the blanket. So, and then in the morning, he says, leave before anyone else sees. This does not seem like a wise plan for two defenseless women, or one defenseless woman, to be doing. It's actually a little bit, when you first read it, you're like, what's happening here? What's going on? But actually, it's all explainable. In the context of what's going on, it all makes sense. So, firstly, traditionally, a servant would sleep at the master's feet. So if you're sleeping at someone's feet, you are indicating that you are the servant in that relationship. They would sleep at their feet. They would kind of ask for or hope that their blanket would kind of get like kicked off, flicked onto them so that they would just have a little bit of warmth. And so by doing that, Ruth is making it really clear that she is the servant in this relationship, that Boaz is the one that holds all the power. She says so in verse 9. She says, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are Redeemer. So she's not only just saying, I'm your servant, she's saying something more. When she says, spread your wings, it could just be a fancy way of saying, spread your blanket over me. But we know that it's more than that. She's actually referencing something that Boaz says in the previous chapter. In chapter 2, verse 12, he kind of declares this blessing. He says this prayer over Ruth. And he says, a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So Boaz has recognized that Ruth has come to take refuge in Israel, under the wings of the God of Israel. And now Ruth is going to him and she's saying, I want to take refuge under you, under your protection. So this is not just kind of like some seedy midnight illicit thing that's going on. That's not what's happening at all. This is a really formal request for him to be the kinsman redeemer, to be the one that will kind of break her out of the poverty. And I know Auntie talked about this a little bit last week, but just as a reminder, this idea of a kinsman redeemer is a relative in the family who has the opportunity to marry a widow of somebody else in the family. So typically it's a brother. So if your brother's wife dies, then the next brother is expected to marry the widow to provide for her. But if there's no brothers left, as is the case for Ruth, then it could be some other relative. So what she's asking him to do is she's asking him, marry me so that we can continue the family line together, so that we can have children and continue the line of my previous husband, continue that line of our family. So that's what she's asking him to do. And at this point, we'll turn and look at what Boaz does. So Boaz, like he's done in the previous chapter, shows that he's a really good guy. He's not doing anything dodgy here. He does everything actually completely right. So think about it from his point of view. He might have noticed this woman in chapter 2. Well, he definitely noticed her. He might have been attracted to her. So now he has this young woman. She's come to him in all her, looking as best as she can with all her perfume on. She's lying down next to him. She's asking, can I share your blanket? She's asked him for marriage. They're out under the stars. And I can imagine that it probably wouldn't have taken very much for them to kind of just give in to their temptations, really. And especially she's here and she's saying, like, I'm your servant. He's the one that has all the power. And he just chooses not to abuse that power. He doesn't do anything at all that's untoward. He chooses that, first of all, he wants to protect her and her reputation. In verse 11 in chapter 3, he says, you've made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. Boaz knows that things need to be done properly. There's a right way of doing things. He knows that actually she's come to him for protection. And so even if he doesn't get to be the redeemer himself, he's going to show, he's going to do it right. He's going to protect her. So the first thing that he says after he said, I will try and do this, is he says, oh, but there's another redeemer who's closer relative, is a closer relative than I am. What that means is this guy, whoever he is, has a stronger claim to being able to be the redeemer for Ruth. And Boaz is saying, well, I have to take it to this guy first. I know you've asked me, but I've got to give this opportunity to this other guy, because otherwise that's not the right way of doing things. In doing so, he risks losing anything that he has with Ruth. So he's choosing to put her protection, her redemption above anything that he can do. He's sacrificing, or potentially sacrificing, any gain that he could have from this, just so that she can be looked after. And then we see again, as the rest of the passage continues, that he really does care about just making sure that Ruth is looked after. So he sends her home in the morning before anyone can see. And the reason for that is not because anything bad has happened, but that he doesn't want people to be gossiping about that. He wants her reputation to be protected, even though she is this foreign widow, probably the lowest person in society in terms of social standing. He wants to make sure that she is protected and that she doesn't end up being accused of something that she hasn't done. And then he doesn't just send her back by himself. He says, it's a bit of a weird passage, the way that it explains it. So in verse 15, bring the garment that you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. So he's given her some barley, but it's a weird way that he explained it. So I imagine that she's wearing like a dress and she's like holding it like this, and he just pours it like into the middle. 6 measures of barley is a lot of barley, according to my commentary. So I think she's like got as much barley as she's carrying. So she's probably like staggering back to the city, kind of like carrying literally as much as she can carry. He wants to make sure that she's looked after. So even if he doesn't get to be the redeemer, he wants to make sure that she is in as safe a place as possible. And so either way, it doesn't matter if he redeems her or not. Either the guy in front of him will redeem her, or he will. And he ends the chapter with this verse that we're going to keep going back to. Or actually, he doesn't. Naomi ends the chapter with this. Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. He wants to fix this urgently. His highest priority is making sure that Ruth and Naomi are protected and looked after. So there's 3 things that I want us to focus on. We could focus on Boaz, and Boaz is doing is a great role model. He's doing lots here, but actually Bert will focus on Boaz and what he does next week. So rather, I'd like to just focus on 3 things that that 3 qualities of Ruth that she shows here that we can kind of take. So firstly, intention. So Ruth knows that she has to do something in order to make this redemption happen. In chapter 2, Boaz has shown kindness to her, but there's no indication that that's going anywhere else. And like we already said, he's a middle-aged guy. I don't think he's got any kind of presumptions that he's just going to be able to go up to this young lady and just be like, hey, let's get married. I want to redeem you. I don't think he has that in his mind. So Ruth knows that she has to be really clear and she has to take action in order to make this happen. When she does, she chooses to pursue Boaz. Boaz, like we said, is kind of a middle-aged guy. Yes, he's wealthy. There's a reason, though. We don't know what it is, but there's a reason why Boaz doesn't yet have a wife. Maybe he's not the most conventionally attractive person. I don't know. But Boaz kind of indicates that, right? In the passage, in verse 11, he talks to Ruth and he says, "Thank you for showing me kindness, for not choosing the young men, whether poor or rich." He's kind of showing that he knows that he's probably not the first pick. And so in doing so, Ruth is choosing to do the same thing that she chooses to do in chapter 1. In chapter 1, she rejects her previous life as a Moabite. She chooses to stick with Naomi, to follow, to be true to that family that she married into. And she does the same thing here. She chooses to let herself be redeemed into that family so that she can carry on the line of Elimelech, her father-in-law, and her husband who died, and Boaz and Naomi. She could have, just like she had the option in chapter 1, she could have just gone and find one of these young guys in the field and kind of just gone off with him. She's a foreigner. She isn't really bound by the rules of Israelite culture in the same way. So she could have definitely gone and done that. But what's really important, I think, is that she does it she doesn't do it half-heartedly. She puts everything into it. She makes sure she's wearing her best clothes, her best perfume. She does everything she can to make herself attractive in order to gain Boaz's favour. So let me give you an example of when I didn't do this, when I wasn't very intentional. This might not bode well for what's coming up for me in the next couple of months, but whenever I've gone to an interview for a job or a university place or whatever, the first interview that I've had at the first location has never gone well. Okay, so everything, all my jobs, all of my two careers, my PGCE placement, everything, I've always had one interview at one place, flopped it. Second interview at another place always goes very well. Okay, so let me tell you about the time then I was thinking about going into teaching. So I'd done a lot of research. I knew what teaching involved. I knew that that's where I kind of felt like I wanted to go. And so I got an interview at a university, a good university. And I was leaving from work. So at work, I wore jeans. It was quite casual. I wore jeans and kind of a short-sleeved shirt. And so I turn up at the interview. And the first thing that the guy does is we sit down. He's wearing like a full three-piece suit. And I'm like, okay. And he just goes, "Do you think you're dressed appropriately for an interview?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm at an interview for a university place. So yes, I think I am dressed appropriately." And he goes, "If you were going for an interview in a school, would you wear this?" I'm like, "Obviously not. Like, I'm not in a school. I'm in a university. Is this not what we wear?" And from then on, the interview just kept going down. He was not impressed with my answers and with my smart comebacks. He then started. So I was working as an electronics engineer. I kind of had. I knew that I was good at physics, but I hadn't covered everything that was on the A-level physics course in my job, obviously, as an electronics engineer. So he then started asking me questions about areas of the course that I had not researched. And I was just like, "I'm sorry, I don't know what Boyle's law is. I can't tell you, something else in physics that I can't think of. I can't tell you what the Hubble constant is. I don't know those things." And he just kind of just continually battered me throughout the interview, just with these like rhetorical questions, like, "Well, do you think you're prepared to study this?" And I'm like, "Yes, I'm prepared, but I want you to teach me. I don't want to like have to come with this already this level of knowledge already." So I didn't get that place. I think it was quite obvious from the moment I went in that I wasn't going to get it. I then had an offer of another place at another university. Turned up to that, very smart. I'd read through the specification, the syllabus for A-level physics. I could talk to them and I could say, oh, you know what? Okay, well, I'm not the hottest on thermodynamics, but I'm very good at electricity. And they really welcomed my honesty. But the fact that I'd looked into it, the fact that I was prepared, made it clear that I knew what I was, that I was being intentional about what happened. And so I see this all the time with my students as well. So there was, in my first year, there was one student in my A-level class, and he wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge, and he wanted to study medicine. And we don't, at my school, we don't tend to get a lot of Oxbridge candidates. And it was in my first year, I was quite inexperienced, but he would constantly pester me with, oh, I don't know how to do this question. I don't know, I didn't quite understand this thing. Sometimes he would come to me and he'd say, what you said last week, that's not what it says on the specification. And that was all fine, that was great, because he really wanted to get to Cambridge and study medicine. That was his goal. He was intentional about doing it. And he got there because he was intentional about making sure he did everything he could to do it. I had a student a couple of years later. She was in my tutor group. She got excellent GCSE results, and she also wanted to study medicine. But she was not intentional about this. She was, oh, well, I've done well at GCSE, so therefore I'll do well at A-level. I'll put in the same amount of work. And I would say to her, like, if she didn't do well on the test, I would say, well, can you look through your test? Can you find out where you went wrong? And then come and ask me about those topics that you don't understand, because I can point them out to you, but you need to speak to me. I encourage all of my classes to constantly send me emails and if they're stuck. And there is a difference, there is a marked difference between the ones who do, who get A's, and the ones who don't, who get like C's and D's. She did not do well. She did not get into medicine because she wasn't intentional about what she was doing. She thought she could just kind of sail through, just like I thought I could sail through my first interview, which I will not be doing for any potential interviews that are coming up in the next few months. I will be wearing a suit, and I will have looked at everything that I can. So for us then, just some questions. Do you lack the intention that Ruth has? Do you just expect God to do everything for you while you kind of just sit back, while you're doing nothing to help your situation? Are you kind of living like Ruth and Naomi were in between chapter 2 and chapter 3, like that survival mode, just trying to get the food, the physiological needs? Are you taking the opportunity to reach out and ask? Just like in Matthew 7. So Matthew 7, I'm sure you know the passage. Ask, and it, Matthew 7, 7. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks, to the one who knocks, it will be opened. So that's Ruth's intention. The next thing I wanted the next property or quality of Ruth that I wanted to think about was her vulnerability. So Ruth really puts herself in an extremely vulnerable position with Boaz. We've said this already, but she lies down at his feet. She's admitting to him by doing that, that she is the servant and that he is the master, that he's the one who has the ability to make something happen. She has the intention to come to him, but she doesn't have the power to make anything happen. So she knows when she does this that she could be rejected, or even worse, right? She's out there in the dark. There's robbers around. She could be attacked. She could be assaulted. She might be just kind of humiliated if he says no. He might decide to go and tell everyone and be like, oh, can you guess what? This Moabite woman, she thought that she would come and be redeemed. She could lose everything in society. So she knows that there's nothing she can do. And she says in verse 9, spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. She's putting her whole future and Naomi's future into this one interaction. Because if he says no, even if he says no in the nicest way, I'm pretty sure he's not going to be letting them glean in the field the next year. It's going to be too awkward. They're going to be losing everything they have. They're going to be completely in poverty, completely destitute. In 1 Peter, in fact, let's ask these questions first. So for us, for you, do you show humility? Do you show vulnerability before your Redeemer. When you come to him, do you lie at his feet? Do you call yourself his servant, just hoping to get just a corner of that garment of protection? Are you fully aware of the helplessness of your situation? 1 Peter 5, verse 6 says, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you." My last quality, My last quality of Ruth that I want us to take away today is confidence. So Ruth shows vulnerability and humility, and she's very intentional. But she also displays this confidence that Boaz will do the right thing. Why else would she go to this place if she wasn't confident that nothing bad would happen to her? If she had any kind of doubt that something dodgy could happen, why would she bother to do that? Why would she not try and arrange the situation and do it in a different way? She's so confident that he's not going to let her down, that he's not going to humiliate or reject her, that nothing even worse is going to happen to her when she's there, that she risks everything that she has in order to gain everything, in order to completely change where they are on that pyramid of needs, going from the bottom, from just survival mode, to having everything and being looked after, being able to continue the family line. Two passages came to mind for me, and they're kind of next to each other. They're on opposite pages in my Bible. So Matthew 14, Jesus walks on water. So I'm sure you know the story, but the disciples are out in the boat and they see this figure coming towards them over the water. And some of them are like, "Oh, it's a ghost." And Peter says, no, that's Jesus. He says, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you." And so Jesus says, "Come," and Peter steps out onto the water and he's like, "Yes, I'm walking on water, I'm doing it." And then he just glances down and he sees the waves and he starts to sink. And he calls out, "Lord, save me." And Jesus pulls him into the boat, and then he kind of just, why do you have such little faith? Peter did it, but he didn't have that complete confidence that Jesus was going to allow him to continue to walk on the water. And then in my Bible, at least, you just flick your eyes over across the page, and there's Matthew 15:27, which is the faith of the Canaanite woman. A Canaanite woman, by the way, similar heritage to Ruth. So Ruth is from that same background. And in this story, there's lots of people crowding around Jesus, and this Canaanite woman comes and she's asking for healing from Jesus. And so she comes to him, and the disciples are saying, "No, go away, you foreigner. Lord, shall we send her away?" And the Canaanite woman and Jesus have this dialogue, and they both use this phrase, "Even the dogs can gather the scraps from under the master's table." And Jesus kind of repeats it back to her, and he says, "Yes, you will be healed. Because of your faith, you will be healed." And so there's that contrast, right? So even those like Peter who said that they were followers of Jesus, those people that know the most about Jesus, maybe those of us in church that have been in church for a while, he doesn't show that continued confidence, that 100% faith that he will do the right thing, that he will do the impossible and keep him walking on water. And then we have this Canaanite woman, just like Ruth. She's asking just for the scraps under the table, just like Ruth, who was gathering the scraps from the harvest when she was gleaning in chapter 2. And she gets commended for her faith, for her confidence in Jesus. Ruth gets commended, or Ruth shows her confidence in Boaz. So for you, do you have confidence in your Redeemer to save you? Or do you just kind of flap around like Peter does, when you just catch a glimpse of the waves, even though the Redeemer is right there? Peter just completely loses faith. Are you humble enough to come and gather just the crumbs from under the master's table? So just as we're about to come to communion, but just as we think about what it means for Boaz the Redeemer here, But we'll talk about this more next week. But if Boaz is not the guy that she thinks he is, all of this kind of goes to waste. If he's not trustworthy, if he's not righteous, then her intention would just kind of be unnoticed. It would be unrewarded. Her vulnerability and her humility would be used against her to chastise her or to humiliate her or worse. Her confidence would be damaged. It would leave her disappointed if Boaz wasn't righteous and trustworthy. But he is righteous and trustworthy. He lives up to the name of kinsman redeemer. Everything we read about Boaz in all three chapters of Ruth show that he is a man who is righteous. He doesn't entertain the thought of doing anything other than the right thing. Ruth puts her life in his hands and he delivers. And so Naomi finishes the chapter with, "The man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." And Bert will continue in chapter 4 and talk about how trustworthy Boaz is and what it looks like for him to be the Redeemer. But we're going to come to communion now. So I'm sure you guys have realized the parallel between Boaz as the Redeemer and Jesus as our Redeemer. For Boaz, and this is a great story in Ruth, but essentially what's happening is this is just making sure that that these women aren't living in poverty. That's a great thing, but there's more at stake than that, right? There's more at stake than just making sure you have a decent existence. So the greater kinsman redeemer is Jesus. Jesus is the real one who is always righteous and trustworthy. He's the one who takes notice of our actions when we come and ask and seek and knock. He's the one who responds. He's the one who responds when we're humble, when we're vulnerable, with compassion, not with malice or humiliation. And Jesus never fails. He's the one that we can put our confidence in and make sure that that he will do the right thing. And so as we come to communion, like Ruth, I think we need to ask, we need to be intentional, we need to come before him. Like Ruth, we need to be vulnerable, we need to humble ourselves, call ourselves his servants. And like Ruth, we need to trust in his providence, in his ability to save us, to bring us salvation and redemption. And just like Boaz, Jesus, the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. And let's pray. Lord Jesus, you are our Redeemer, God. You are the one who is trustworthy, the one who is righteous, who will do the right thing. And Lord, we come before you and we remember your sacrifice. We remember what it took in order for this to happen. So as we come to communion, Lord, just would you just listen to our requests? Would you accept us as your servants, just gathering the scraps under your table? And Lord, would you remind us of your promise that you will always stay true? Amen.